the social change of climate change.
If we want to stabilize climate, we have to recognize that for the poor people in the world, it's eradicating poverty.
That's Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. We'll talk to him about the latest edition of his book, Plan B. It's updated to Plan B 4.0.
How else are we going to actually build demand for this green economy that we keep hearing about? I mean, you have to actually have people who want to take advantage of these goods and services.
And that's social change expert David Gershon. He talks about how to create the social and political will to do something about climate change in his book, Social Change 2.0. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On July 13th, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced plans to bring clean energy legislation to the Senate floor by the last week of July. The House passed such legislation last year, but the Senate has been dragging its feet. What will be in the final bill, and whether it will do much to get us off fossil fuels in time to stave off climate catastrophe, is not yet known. But many in America aren't holding their breath. They're moving ahead, with or without government, to lay out a vision of a clean energy future and a way to get ordinary citizens mobilized to bring it about. Both our guests today are committed to that vision. First, we speak with Lester Brown, longtime writer and activist on global environmental issues. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and was called one of the world's most influential thinkers by the Washington Post. Founder of World Watch, he helped to pioneer the idea of sustainable development back in the 1970s. His best-known books are perhaps the Plan B series, and we talked to him about his latest, Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. A central idea of the book is that tackling climate change isn't just about changing our energy technology from dirty to clean. It's also about social change, specifically eradicating poverty. We need to educate poor women, empower poor farmers, and create food security along with energy security. He says unless we all get together to do that, our civilization could be doomed. Well, Lester Brown, welcome to Writer's Voice. In your book, Plan B, you say we're in a race between political and climate tipping points. There seems to be a huge spread between the two.
There is. And when we were working on Plan B and developing our plan to cut carbon emissions, we didn't ask the question, you know, what will be politically feasible, but instead we started with the science and we asked the question, how much and how fast do we have to cut carbon emissions if we want to save the Greenland ice sheet, for example?
And what does that mean? I mean, why do we have to save the Greenland ice sheet?
If the Greenland ice sheet were to melt entirely, sea level would rise by 23 feet, and many of the U.S. coastal cities would be underwater. That would include much of Manhattan, for example, Miami, New Orleans, just to cite a few. The mall in downtown Washington would be underwater. So this is the basic decision we have to make as to whether we want to try and save the Greenland ice sheet or not. Because if we don't, then we're going to see an enormous sea rise. And I mean, I'm talking about the Greenland ice sheet. I could also include the West Antarctic ice sheet. That's the other area where we're seeing a lot of melting right now. And there's a possibility the West Antarctic ice sheet could break up. If that were to break up, we'd have another 15-foot rise in sea level. So what we're looking at here is unless we get our act together and really cut carbon emissions fast, we're going to see some very substantial rises in sea level. The latest reports looking at ice melting and rising sea level indicate that sea level could rise by as much as 6 feet during this century. That would be within the lifetime of today's youngsters, conceivably. But even a 3-foot rise in sea level would create chaos. a 3-foot rise in sea level would cover half the rice land in Bangladesh, for example. It would cover much of the Mekong Delta, which produces half the rice in Vietnam, Vietnam being the world's number two rice exporter after Thailand. So whether we're looking at cities around the world, like London and Shanghai, for example, and a number of U.S. cities, we're looking at a substantial loss of rice production, of the world's rice production capacity, and we're looking at the potential of hundreds of millions of rising sea refugees. I mean, I've tried to think this through in the United States, and what we could see if we stay with business as usual and we begin to see sea level rising along the lines most recently projected, we would suddenly have two real estate markets in this country. One would be in coastal regions where real estate prices would be plummeting. The other would be in the rest of the country where they would be soaring, because suddenly a lot of people would have to relocate. And it's not only their homes that would be lost, but their jobs. I mean, there are a lot of factories and commercial buildings that are in low-lying parts of this country. So it would put so much stress on societies, on governments, that many would begin to break down. And we're looking at a situation unlike anything we've ever seen before.
You know, I'd like to ask you, and maybe you can't answer this, because it does seem that the science is always changing. That is, it's getting more and more dire in terms of predictions. But are you talking about something that would happen by the end of the century gradually? Or are you talking about something that, with business as usual, we just don't know, and there could be a sudden tipping point and sea levels could rise very suddenly?
One of the tipping points we have to be concerned with is where we would reach the point of no return with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. At what point would it become irreversible? Because once it became clear that we're going to lose the Greenland ice sheet, it would have an enormous psychological effect on people in the world. And the next generation would be asking us, why didn't you do something when there was still time? How could you leave us a world descending into chaos? The situation with the West Antarctic ice sheet is somewhat different in the sense that it is already breaking up. I mean, we've had pieces of it breaking off now for more than a decade, and some very substantial pieces. And what could happen in the not-too-distant future is that there could be enough of it breaking off that we would see a rise of 2 feet in sea level in a matter of years, for example. If something like that were to happen, it would be the equivalent of Pearl Harbor for Americans. It would really begin to get scary. The problem is, by the time we reach the point where it starts to get scary, it may be too late. Nature sort of determines these thresholds of, you know, when things become irreversible, and we don't know exactly where they are. Nature's the timekeeper, but we can't see the clock.
Right. Your book, Plan B, has a plan to avoid this. Hopefully we still can avoid it. You certainly put out a compelling case that it can be done, and you say it can be done with what we've got now, with the technology and the knowledge that we have today. One of the things that I found most interesting in your book, among many, is the way you connect up the four pillars of this plan. You say we need to cut CO2 emissions 80% by 2020, and we might have to cut them even more. So I'd like to ask you, if we have to cut them more, can we still do that with your plan? You say we need to cap world population at 8 billion people or lower. We need to eradicate poverty, and you actually kind of put that as the key to all of this. And you say we need to restore Earth's natural systems. So I'd like to take these in turn and start with that eradicating poverty. Why do you put that as the keystone of this whole plan?
Well, there's a very close link between poverty and population growth. The large families in the world do not occur in affluent societies. They occur among the poor. And what we need to do is to create an environment. This is a social, a political environment in which we can all work together. If we want to stabilize climate, we have to recognize that for the poor people in the world, it's eradicating poverty, which is their huge issue. It is also true that there's a very close relationship between the level of female education and family size. So if we want to eradicate poverty, we're going to have to invest in education. That means making sure that youngsters everywhere get at least a primary school education, and that includes girls as well as boys. It means we need at least a basic health care for the world's poor, and that doesn't have to be, you know, open-heart surgery, but it does have to include vaccination for childhood diseases, for example, and that sort of thing. It also means that we're probably going to have to develop school lunch programs to get children in school and with enough food, that enough in their stomachs that they can actually learn. If we're talking about stabilizing climate, we're also talking about stabilizing population. If we're talking about stabilizing population, we're talking about eradicating poverty. And we're also, if we're talking about eradicating poverty, we're talking about protecting and restoring the Earth's natural support systems. And in our highly urbanized world, we sort of forget how dependent we all are on the Earth's natural systems and resources. The economy is entirely dependent on things like forests and grasslands and soils and aquifers and fisheries and so forth. And if we continue to damage and destroy those, and also to disrupt the climate system on which agriculture is so intimately dependent, then we're just not going to make it. So we have to look at these things as a package. We're either going to succeed on all four fronts, or we're going to fail on all four. It's not as though we can stabilize population but not do anything about poverty, or that we can restore the Earth's natural support systems and maintain them unless we can control population growth and so forth. So things are really tied together here, and it's the entire world that's involved. I mean, I mentioned earlier the effect of rising sea level on the rice-growing river deltas of Asia. I think I mentioned Bangladesh and Vietnam. There are another 20 rice-growing river deltas in Asia. And the idea that ice melting in the far North Atlantic could shrink the rice harvest of Asia is not immediately intuitive. You actually have to think about it to realize that there is a direct link there. Or another one would be the melting glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau. These are the glaciers whose ice melt sustains the flow of the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers, for example. If those glaciers disappear, then the flow of these rivers will drop dramatically during the dry season. And this, of course, will disrupt the irrigation systems of China. And China is the world's leading producer of wheat and the world's leading producer of rice.
We're talking with Lester Brown about his book Plan B 4.0. It follows previous versions of this and has a great deal of new material. You mentioned China as being the leading producer of wheat. You say early in the book that it took you a long time. You said until recently you resisted the idea that food shortages could bring down our global civilization. Now, you talk about how China, because of this, you know, China isn't blind to this growing threat. China and other countries as well are beginning to buy up land in Africa and other poor nations as a form of food security. In fact, some have called it a land grab. Talk about this.
In early 2007, we saw a dramatic rise in world grain and soybean prices. And with that rise, we saw some of the grain exporting countries beginning to restrict or even ban grain exports in order to keep their food prices from spiraling out of control. They included wheat exporters like Russia and Argentina. They included rice exporters like Vietnam. And suddenly, the importing countries lost confidence in the world market as an assured supply of food. And so in response to that, many of the more affluent importing countries have begun to buy or lease on long-term land in other countries. And these include, importantly, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, and China, but a number of other countries as well. But these are the three leaders. And it was ironic to read in an article in The Economist that there had been a celebration in the king's palace in Saudi Arabia when they got the first shipment of rice from land they had bought in Ethiopia. And what's so ironic about this is that countries are buying land in countries like Ethiopia, which is heavily dependent on the World Food Program, which is the UN-operated food aid program. They're heavily dependent on that for their survival. And so we have people in more affluent countries now competing for land and water resources very directly in countries that are already on the edge of famine. And this is going to create enormous stresses within many of these countries like Ethiopia, the Sudan, Indonesia, other low-income countries in Africa where huge chunks of land are being leased or bought. And it represents a new chapter in world food security. I remember reading about the Saudis buying land in Pakistan, and then the Saudis began to worry whether they could actually get that food out or not.
Because Pakistan isn't exactly very secure.
Exactly, and the Pakistan government said they would allot 100,000 troops to the protection of the Saudi investment in agriculture in Pakistan to make sure they could get the grain out that they produced on this land. And I was asking myself, from whom are they protecting it? Is it the farmers who were displaced by the government in order to get this land to sell, or is it consumers who are going hungry in Pakistan because there's not enough grain because part of their land and water resources are producing grain for Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, you know, after I started reading your book and reading this part of it, I got very interested, and I wrote a column on this for an online publication that I write for, and I called up a senior policy analyst at the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, and I thought she had a very interesting take on this. She said, you know, the idea of foreigners investing in land abroad in itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but that there is a right way and a wrong way to go about it. And basically what she said is, if what you are doing is investing in small farmers in those countries to enable them to better bring their surplus to market, you know, for example, I think of our own local company, Dean's Beans Organic Coffee and Cocoa. You know, they invest in farmers' cooperatives abroad. Mm-hmm. And those cooperatives then sell their beans to Dean's Beans at a fair price and bring us really great coffee right here in this local area as well as around the world. So investment itself is not such a bad thing. You're really talking about the way it's being done, the kind of power relationship. I'd like to ask you, first of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, what is necessary to kind of nudge that international investment and international policy toward the right way of doing it and away from the wrong way?
It would take some internationally agreed upon sort of guiding principles of the conditions under which these investments could take place. And they would have to be done in such a way that the local people could benefit from them. But what's happening now is that a lot of governments in poverty-stricken countries are just eager to get hard currency from wherever they can, that they'll do almost anything to get it. I also think that there's probably a lot of money moving under the table here. And what we're seeing in more than one case is a case where a government has agreed to sell a huge chunk of land to South Korea or China or someone, and then when the people become aware of it, there's such an uprising that they have to cancel the agreements. And this is exactly what's happened with China in the Philippines. And I think they were trying to lease like a couple or buy a couple million acres. I mean, these are huge chunks of land. And it happened with South Korea, and I think it was Madagascar, where a South Korean company bought a huge chunk of the available farmland.
Half the available farmland.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. Some of these chunks of land being bought are, you know, the size of Belgium. They're not trivial.
So let's talk about Plan B 4.0, some of the ways in which we can actually reach that 80% cut by 2020, or maybe even go further if we need to. You start out with what a lot of people call the low-hanging fruit, and that's efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to find out just how much buildings are responsible for carbon emissions. It's a huge amount.
That's right, because you have to heat buildings, you have to cool them, you have to light them. So buildings do loom large in the energy consumption picture. The good news is that we can make our buildings much more efficient. Just if we were to go from incandescent bulbs to compact fluorescents, we can cut electricity use by about 75%. But if we go from incandescents with LEDs or light-emitting diodes that are becoming price-wise now more and more competitive, and combine them with smart sensors that would turn lights off when no one's in the room, that would just sort of be automatic, then we can cut electricity use for lighting by 90%. And that's enough to close 700 of the world's 2,300 or so coal-fired power plants.
700, well, that's a huge amount. That's almost a third.
It is.
We're talking with Lester Brown about how to save civilization. His book is Plan B 4.0. Brown is founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute. I asked him if he saw any promising developments on the policy front of dealing with climate change.
There are some exciting things happening now that are not yet well known. And we have a lot of things in at the national level in the policy pipeline that are going to help us cut carbon emissions. Not nearly enough to get the 80% cut we talk about in Plan B 4.0, but at least enough to make a huge difference. We have, for example, automobile fuel efficiency standards that were announced in February, the first month after the Obama administration took office. And then we have a huge number of appliance efficiency standards to be implemented, because for several years, the Department of Energy did not do anything with the legislation on appliance efficiency standards. They never translated that legislation into actual regulations that would affect the efficiency of household appliances. So there's a huge backlog there waiting to be tapped, and that is now being done. And then we have the incentives to develop wind and solar and geothermal energy as part of the stimulus program. And then we have the federal government going to set its own goals for reducing carbon emissions. And that's going to be fun because of the way Obama did it. He didn't say this is what the federal government is going to do. He asked each department and agency to come up with a plan to cut carbon emissions. And, of course, no one wants to be on the bottom of that list, so there's going to be a real scramble to see what they can do. And then we have Lisa Jackson at EPA saying that, you know, all the large companies in the U.S., large businesses, are going to have to come up with a carbon footprint that'll be done each year. And that's going to make a difference as well. So there are a lot of things beginning to happen now. And I like to think in terms of social tipping points, and I have in my own mind sort of three models of social change. One is the Pearl Harbor model, where you have a catastrophic event that changes everything. The second is what I call the Berlin Wall model, where you have opposition to something rising and rising, and suddenly it changes everything. And the third one is what I call the sandwich model, where you have pressure for change welling up from the grassroots and leadership at the top that's responsive to that change. That's when you get rapid change, and I think that's what we have in this country now.
One thing we haven't talked about, which I think is a very central argument in your book, is the role of the market, the limitations of the role of the market, and how we can, you know, what might be necessary to move things forward, to even push markets. One thing you say is that the market itself, or the free market, or the global market, doesn't respect the carrying capacity of natural systems. And you have a very interesting example. You give the example of overfishing.
Yeah, the basic problem with markets are that, one, they don't incorporate indirect costs. When you buy a gallon of gasoline, you pay the cost of pumping the oil, getting it to a refinery, and then getting the gasoline to the local service station. You do not pay the costs of the health care costs of treating respiratory illnesses from breathing polluted air. You certainly don't get the cost of climate change included in the price of the gasoline. So the market's been misleading us for a long time. It's been saying, it's been trying to tell us that fossil fuels are cheap when, in fact, they're very costly. And the challenge to us is to incorporate these indirect costs into the price of the gasoline, the coal-fired electricity, or whatever. So the market tells the truth. And we can do that very simply by restructuring taxes. We can lower income taxes, offset that by a rise in the carbon tax, for example. And that would begin to restructure the economy in a way that would reduce, would accelerate the shift from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy like wind and solar, geothermal, and so forth.
You talk about $200 a ton of carbon. I think, you know, the last I looked, it was something like $10 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get from here to there? And how do we do it in a way that we don't impoverish people even more? I mean, you talk about income taxes, but there are an awful lot of people who aren't even working now who would be absolutely crushed by the kind of huge rise, let's say, in the gas tax that you propose in order to get us to that price of carbon at about $200 a ton.
Mm-hmm. As a general matter, there would be an offset. I mean, we would lower income taxes and offset that with a rise in the carbon tax. So the amount of tax we pay would not change. But as you note, there could be some people that would be more affected by that than others. And so you would have to devise the system in order to take that into account. I mean, we have a general way of doing that in our society so that poor people are not hit too hard, and we call it the progressive income tax. So we have a huge precedent for adjusting these things so that they're not too hard on low-income people or people who don't have jobs or what have you.
Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. Stay tuned for more after the break.
One love, one heart, let's get together and feel all right.
To the children's choir,
one love,
to the children's choir,
one heart,
singing.
Let's get together and feel all right.
Oh.
Let's get together.
Of the children,
one
there is one question I'd really love to ask:
one
is there a place for those homeless children?
Back here with Writer's Voice, we're talking with environmental policy analyst and author Lester Brown about his latest book, Plan B 4.0. And finally, what can people listening to this program do? Is it just a question of calling their congressperson? How can they get to find out more about Plan B and some of these other issues?
Well, Plan B, the book, Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, is online. at earthpolicy.org, and you can download it free of charge. You can read it online. So the information is available. And I think last year, or with Plan B 3.0, I think there were 39,000 copies of the book downloaded and 160,000 copies of various chapters downloaded. So people are using it. But the question I'm most frequently asked is the one you just asked, which is, you know, people ask, what can I do? And I think many of them expect me to say, change your light bulbs and recycle your newspapers and so forth. And these are important. But more important is becoming politically active. Pick an issue that's important to you and go to work on it politically. Find some friends who are also interested and concerned. And it can be, you know, banning the use of tax money for buying bottled water, for example, which is such a big farce. The difference between bottled water and tap water in most of the country is that the bottled water costs 1,000 times as much as the tap water. But the quality of tap water is as good, and in some cases better than that of bottled water. Or it could be working to ban local coal-fired power plants, for example, to close them and replace them with wind or solar or geothermal or what have you. So pick an issue and go to work on it. If you're concerned about population growth, join one of the population groups that's working to try and stabilize world population. So get involved. For decades, we as environmentalists have been talking about saving the planet. And as I think about it, I think the planet's going to be around for some time. The challenge we're facing is to save civilization itself, because civilization as we know it cannot survive a continuation of the environmental trends, whether it's rising CO2 levels or whether it's deforestation or the depletion of aquifers or the collapse of fisheries. We can't survive a continuation of these trends. So get involved and go to work on one of them. And if we do that, we can make a difference. I mean, the thing about saving civilization is that it's not a spectator sport. It's not something where we can sit around and hope someone else is going to do it. I mean, it's our civilization, and our children and grandchildren are, it's their future that's at stake here. So we need to become politically active. And if we do, we can change things very fast.
Well, Lester Brown, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. Your book is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, and we will link to your website at Earth Policy Institute.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to the download of the book by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with David Gershon about Social Change 2.0, a blueprint for reinventing our world. Stay tuned. We first spoke with David Gershon several years ago about his book, Low Carbon Diet, A 30-Day Program to Lose 5,000 Pounds. That book, and a companion workbook for children, was a guide for families and communities to get together to slash their carbon footprint. Gershon is a founder and president of the Empowerment Institute, a school for social change. It works with governments, organizations, and businesses to help institutions change behavior on a system-wide scale. The city of Seattle is one of his clients, putting his ideas about reducing our carbon footprint into practice across the urban area. His newest book is Social Change 2.0. I started our interview by asking Gershon, what's the difference between Social Change 1.0 and 2.0?
1.0 is about passing legislation to try to create change. That is our traditional way of trying to move social change forward. And legislation has two aspects. One is passing a law, command and control, to force someone to change, be it an individual or a business. And the other part is paying someone to change, incentives of one sort or another, a tax break or a discount on purchasing something, a incentive or a disincentive. And while that is traditionally how social change has been carried out, when the order of magnitude of social change reaches a certain point, you actually have to get major transformative change to happen through the legislative process. It's not designed for that. It's designed to be incremental at best, And what we're seeing happening in Washington right now is you can't even get incremental change because the whole system is so frozen or stuck. So when a system that needs to create change is unable to make that change happen, then we either have the system start to break down, which is what we saw with the economic system. We're seeing that happen with the climate system. We're seeing that happen in the education system. Or it has to break through. In systems theory, there's a term called second-order change, which is the point in time where a system either breaks down or it has to be reorganized to a higher level of functioning or social value. Social change 2.0 is designed to bring about second-order change or organize systems at a higher level of functioning and social value.
What you call second-order change really, it sounds, depends on empowering people from the bottom up in building the political will to change by getting people to connect together with each other and with their communities to actually push their society to change. So it's second order is a fancy term, but you really break it down to the grassroots level.
We break it down, and it's important when you think at the big picture what the difference is between 1.0 and 2.0. But as you point out, the how of it is that if you can't force someone to change through passing a law, and you can't pay someone to change, then what's left is you have to motivate them. You have to inspire them. You have to empower them. And they actually have to be the change. It's not about the government doing it. It's about passing. It's like in business they have this term called a workaround. You have to work around the system that's broken and directly get to the end user who they are aspiring to be able to get to change. And if you can get to them directly and help them make those changes, and part of how we do that through this whole empowerment methodology is a vision that pulls them, that is exciting, where they want to go toward it as opposed to something that they are repelled by.
Or forced into. You know, let me ask you a question about this. Before we go into this very exciting model, I mean, it was just really thrilling to read about, and there are communities, as you say, 300 communities around the country that are doing this. You know, I interviewed Ralph Nader. You know, his most recent book is Only the Super Rich Can Save Us.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I said, Ralph Nader, I said, you, as an individual, you changed the whole landscape of consumer protection in this country. And, you know, then you can point to the social movements, the labor movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement. These were the forces that changed. And now you're saying only the super rich can save us? And he said, yeah. He said, because we don't have democracy anymore. Citizens were able to change things before because they could apply pressure. He said, now the rulers are so disengaged that we can't.
Yeah.
How would you answer that?
Well, he's unable to see beyond the 1.0 framework, which is top-down, in my judgment, and passing legislation. And this is one of the challenges, because unless one understands this other paradigm, which he actually has been part of, but he's been part of it more indirectly. It's where most NGOs are operating, which is to attempt to get change to happen through 1.0 command and control or financial incentives or disincentives or protest. And he's played with all of them. But if one doesn't understand this other world, then one doesn't really appreciate that there is another option other than trying to get what kind of change that would be, an oligarchy. I mean, I don't know what's getting super rich to
plutocracy.
Yeah, plutocracy. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a function of a blind side that I think many people have, who have spent their lives in lobbying pursuits, and thinking that the goal is to get democracy in that way with a big, well, it's still a little D, I guess, but it's democracy defined by a constitutional apparatus rather than democracy defined by individuals within communities saying, yes, we can do something, here's how, and then making it happen, and then scaling that up, building a movement.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with social change expert David Gershon about how to build the kind of popular demand for tackling climate change that will move the larger society and our legislators. His book is Social Change 2.0. So how does it work? You talk about, for example, the city of Portland, which was the first community that took on some of your ideas, that adopted your what you called then the Sustainable Lifestyle Program.
Yes.
Tell us about that program. Tell us what Portland did and how you did it.
Well, the first place, Francesca, that I want to start in, before I go into some of the how-to, is some of the basic framework. So there are five basic ideas that make up Social Change 2.0. One is the idea of taking direct responsibility for the change we want. If we want to reduce the carbon footprint of the planet, or the carbon footprint of America, or the carbon footprint of my community, I have to look at my own carbon footprint. So rather than looking outside of myself for the source of the problem or solution, I look at myself as the problem and the solution. And I begin to look at how I can make those changes directly. And we call that the practice of empowerment. And we've built a whole behavior change methodology around being able to engage citizenry specifically around the issue of sustainable living or low-carbon living. And we built out a program very carefully looking at all the ways that I contribute to the environmental footprint or the carbon footprint of my community. And then in that case, we put a number next to it, and we crafted a whole set of actions and a programmatic approach for meeting guides, and then we built what we found to be a core ingredient in getting people to actually act on their good intention after they had an effective program, and that was a peer support group, which we called an eco team. And then we began to move it forward, and we called it Low Carbon Diet, a 30-day program to lose 5,000 pounds. And we found that on average, households are reducing their footprint somewhere around 25%. And it's a big deal, because half of the footprint of a city like Portland is the individual, the resident. In communities that don't have a lot of business or industry, it's up to 90%. So in this particular issue, this is a huge part of the solution. And not only that, but it's also the driver for building a low-carbon economy or green goods and services. So you're building the demand side for bringing that whole thing forward. And once you've got citizens who say, yes, I'm ready to reduce my footprint, but I need help with this bike lane, or, you know, public transit system, or with incentives so that I could put solar on my roof or in my yard, can you pass legislation to help me? So it's not do it for me, because do it for us, but I'm not doing my part. It's I'm doing my part. I need your help to go further. And that's just one of the principles. I mean, there's four others that I can speak to over time, but I wanted to ground it with that core piece, because it is really the foundation of Social Change 2.0, which is the practice of empowerment, designing a strategy that enables behavioral change. And then the second part really is how one scales it through a whole set of community organizing tools.
So what you're saying is you get individuals to make a commitment through these eco teams that they are part of to change their behavior. They then come up against some real institutional barriers, and because they're already organized and working together, they start pushing against those barriers and asking a government, asking for legislation that can enable them to do what they want to do. And at the same time, they're building demand for green businesses that can actually supply them what they need. So this is kind of a tripartite of citizen, government, and business.
And I would add around the business piece that they are actually building demand and asking business. And we've seen happen in many communities where they've gone in to try to purchase certain things that were not there. Those local businesses then went and spoke to the manufacturers. We've seen this happen, for example, with Unilever, that was very interested in tracking our work in the 90s to see where market demand was going. So it was a very interesting phenomena of observing how you can also influence what gets produced in society and the qualities of what they need to buy a certain product. So yeah, it's quite a powerful process, you bet.
You know, you give the example of a Vermonter, Wes Sanders, who goes into churches, gives Sunday sermons actually to do this. You know, how does he do that? You know, he goes in, what does he do, and then what happens? Here's maybe where you can kind of, through example, tell us about some of the tools that you've given people to use.
Wes Sanders is a very interesting example of what it looks like when, you know, you have a committed citizen who says, I want to make change happen, because he was frustrated that his local government wasn't doing very much. He was frustrated that there was no legislation happening, and he said, I need to figure this thing out. And he found us and got very excited about our low-carbon diet program, and he started getting people involved, and he would give these sermons, green sermons, if you will. He got to be sometimes giving the sermon for a Sunday, or he got asked to lead some meeting. And he would get people involved. He learned how to tell the story in a context relevant for faith-based groups. He also would speak to sustainability-type groups and speak differently to that community. But he got them going. He's now single-handedly started some 63 of these eco-teams, these 5 to 8 household groups that actually go through the low-carbon diet. He single-handedly has helped reduce the carbon footprint going into the atmosphere by 1 billion pounds, one individual, and sometimes more than any city that I've heard of, actually trying to engage citizenry, albeit they have other ways that they are attempting to do some of that through their own, you know, efficiency in their municipal operations. But he's an inspiration, and there's a lot of people out there that are now stepping up, some 300 communities, and many people like Wes. Although I would say Wes is a special category, but certainly many people that are doing amazing things and taking matters into their own hands.
You talk about also these world cafes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which is a way of getting people together. Tell us about those.
Well, another one of the tools, when we were looking at the question, and one of the key ideas, and I will sort of allude to this notion of one of the other five principles, which we call the diffusion of innovation, or specifically how to get an idea or social innovation to scale up. And one of the things that we looked at as we started working in communities was that the most effective way was to be able to engage partners, faith-based groups, service clubs, businesses, schools, anybody that is somewhat of an, where there's some kind of organization with members or constituents or what have you, and then help them reach out to those constituents. And so to do that, which is how one could actually scale up a low-carbon diet program or what we call a cool community, you need to provide them a tool, something that is easy to use, does not require a lot of knowledge around the global warming issue, scientifically speaking, and can get a lot of these teams formed at one time. And so partnering with colleague of mine, Juanita Brown, who created the World Cafe, which is a conversational process where people sit around a table in groups of four talking about, in her language, questions that matter. We started looking at how to engage people in this very creative way where they would share with one another their fears and their hopes around the issue of climate change. Then we would walk them through the slide presentation, which lays out the case for how our history and how a cool community could go to scale. And then we would engage them to start eco-teams. And we were very successful in building what we call the Global Warming Cafe tool to complement the low-carbon diet behavior change tool. And then we would train the local community organizers who were running these cool communities to implement them. And so they're now doing them all over the country, all over the world. And it's a very powerful process because, A, it can get a lot of people into action, but B, it also empowers these local partner groups to be able to really get something done. And it empowers a whole community because you can get lots and lots of these cafes happening and within a relatively short time be able to actually scale up a cool community, which is one of the key challenges with 2.0. you know, it's one thing to empower, but if you can't force everyone to change like command and control aspires to do, then you actually have to empower them or motivate them. And to do that, you actually have to build the tools.
We're talking with David Gershon about his book, Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. I was thinking, as you were talking, about how this could be a terrific jobs program. You know, back in the 1930s, with artists not being able to make a living, you know, they were engaged by the federal government to go out.
That is a great idea. Yeah.
In fact, there is a program, I believe it's in the Bronx, which has trained peer educators in housing projects to teach their neighbors about recycling, and it pays them to do that. So I'm just wondering, you know, this would be a terrific way to get people in, you know, in all kinds of communities to be empowering each other on climate change.
Well, I think that is an interesting idea. And in fact, one thing we are getting ready to launch, probably in about a couple of months, is something we're calling the Cool Community Core. And this is targeting high school and college students in these communities who would then potentially get service learning credit or other ways of being recognized for starting these teams, including learning global warming cafes and doing the actual organizing in the neighborhoods. There's a whole neighborhood model that I haven't shared yet for how you can actually do this block by block as well.
Oh, that's great. But before you get, well, I know you have the ear of Al Gore. Is that right?
I wouldn't say I quite have his ear, but I'm, you know, maybe a couple of ears away from him.
All right. Well, why don't you put that idea forth? Because we could sure use a green jobs program like this.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. We could. And that is a very good idea. And one of the things about all these communities we work with is that when you combine carbon reduction with low-carbon economic development, which is what we're doing, it starts to become a very dynamic conversation. Because it's not just about something we have to do for the planet, it's also something that can have immediate benefits for the economy and for the quality of life in a community.
Exactly.
So I think this idea of green jobs vis-a-vis the climate change, this global warming cafe and low-carbon diet in general, and then, of course, what it generates through the demand in the system, I think is a big deal. You know, think about it. How else are we going to actually build demand for this green economy that we keep hearing about? I mean, you have to actually have people who want to take advantage of these goods and services.
And can afford to do it.
And point well made. Yep, actually can afford to do it. Yep.
Yeah, that's great. So tell us about your neighborhood model.
Well, one of the things that we have been, so along the way, when we were doing this work in the 90s with some 20,000 people in this country and several hundred thousand around the world to start working on the issue of sustainable living, what we discovered was that we were able to build a program that could measurably help people adopt new lifestyle practices, sustainable lifestyle practices. We found, you know, we could have substantive impact on average 25% reduction in their environmental footprint. It broke down by transportation, water, energy, and so forth, different numbers. We also had longitudinal studies done that showed that once the behaviors were changed, they were sustained 2 years later, so that this was a significant impact that was sustained over time. But the third issue that was significant to be able to actually pull this off through this Social Change 2.0 model was, how do you get enough people to do something so you have a significant impact on conservation of resources or air quality or water quality or carbon footprint or whatever? And we tried a lot of different approaches for how we formed these small groups called eco-teams. And we tried it through service clubs, faith-based groups, social networks, and just about every kind of formation you could imagine. And then we came across the neighborhood as one of them. And we found what happened was that at a neighborhood level, specifically a block, when you brought people together, you were able to meet many benefits. You had many different benefits that were beyond just doing the right thing for the environment. In particular, you had getting to know my neighbors and increasing the quality of life on the block that I live on, because I now have people who are looking after one another. I have a place where my child can go if I come home late from work. I have more safety in my block because people are, you know, connected with one another, looking out for what's going on the block. So overall quality of life improves. And so we found a script over time through some market research and our own observation of what was working on these blocks that went something like this. Hi, I'm your neighbor. I'd like to invite you to a neighborhood gathering in my home, sponsored by the city of Portland, or the city of Philadelphia, or Kansas City, three of the cities we worked with among many, to learn how to better conserve resources for the sake of our children, get to know each other better as neighbors, and create a healthier, safer, more livable block. The meeting is this Thursday night, 7:30 to 9. Can you make it? And what we found was that when that message was delivered by a neighbor to another neighbor, 85% of the people, approximately, were predisposed and said, yes, I can make that. This is great. About half would actually come. And of the people who came, about 75% would join, which came to a recruitment rate of 1 out of every 4 people on the block, or 25%, which is so profound and unlike anything that, you know, one had ever seen before in this kind of organizing. And often people just closed their door when people knocked on their door. So this particular set of benefits delivered by an individual to their neighbors could get people through this program, which was actually a 7-meeting program. We found this not only happened in Portland, an early adopter for sustainability kinds of issues, but it happened in Philadelphia or Kansas City, Missouri or Columbus, Ohio, that are by no means that. Because of the co-benefits, and this is an example of one of the other principles that I speak to in Social Change 2.0, which is the design and implementation of what I call a transformative social innovation. How we actually invent new capabilities, or what it's known as social innovations. This, we invented this thing through lots of trial and error, and there's a whole iterative learning process around that. And it worked. It disseminated to many different cities, and the process was quite profound. And so we were also using this whole idea of how one diffuses an innovation, yet another tool, which I haven't really spent a lot of time on, but the process by which you work with what they call early adopters who seek out the new. They have a high tolerance for experimentation. They represent about 15% of a block. And then at a critical, when you get to about 15%, you hit this critical mass point where it starts diffusing on its own momentum. And so we found, for example, that particular message, those three benefits delivered by a neighbor to a neighbor, was getting into the late majority. So the social innovation around livability, doing something for the sake of our children, and greater connectivity among neighbors. When you brought those three things together, we got well into the late majority, which is the last group of after the early majority and late majority. And we were able to diffuse this. And so once one understands the diffusion of innovation research, then you can very carefully target these early adopter blocks and early adopters who live on the block, early adopter cities, and work smarter, which is one of our core goals of Social Change 2.0, is to have us learn how to work smarter around some of the social change that we're trying to do.
The book is Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. Visit our website at writersvoice.net to find a link to more information about the book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.